McKinley Blankenship, Ms. Folletti, and Ms. Tyson. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, probably 3 or 4 minutes.
How about
three? How about we pick a three number? Will work, three. I think.
Can't plug 3 or 4 into the timer. It's not.
I understand.
Smart.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. You may begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Carla Folletti. I was appointed by the Towsville County Circuit Court to represent Robert Blankenship in this appeal. This is a fairly straightforward, what I would say could possibly be a fairly easy case even for the court to look at. It's a matter of statutory interpretation and whether or not the rules of evidence, and specifically Rule 403, apply to the rape shield laws as stated in 18.2.67.7:1. Mr. Blankenship argues that they most certainly do, because on the face of the statute in E, it says specifically that a prior conviction of a sex offense may be or can be admitted subject to the rules of evidence, and it even...
Well, let me ask this question. Rule 2:403 is a rule of evidence promulgated by the Supreme Court. 18.2.67.7:1 is a statute enacted by the General Assembly. Statutes always take precedence over rules of court. So why should we even consider whether 2:403 has any application?
Because the statute specifically says Rule 2:403 applies when you look at letter E of the statute.
Well, let me ask this question.
I stand corrected.
All elements of 67.7, the statute, all
yes.
Elements of the
yes.
Statute in A, subsections A and B are met?
They may be.
Well, I'm asking... based on my review of the record, the notice was given.
Oh, yes, sir. The notice was given,
it
yes.
It is the type of conviction that the General
Absolutely.
Assembly said you get to put in.
Absolutely.
Well, 403 is the it's essentially unfair. It's something that's so unfairly prejudicial.
Correct.
It doesn't come in. That's a highly discretionary standard, it seems to me. If the trial court found that it wasn't unduly prejudicial, how can we reverse that?
Well, the trial court did not do the balancing test, and the trial court, it must do the balancing test. There is no way that the trial court could even determine if the probative value outweighed the prejudicial effect without knowing something about the prior conviction.
Well, didn't the trial court have the prior conviction and the underlying police report before it at the pretrial motion?
It did have. It did, Your Honor. However, nowhere on the record was a balancing test done. And the record is very important here.
If a rational trial judge, the hypothetical rational trial judge, if a rational trial judge could believe that the prior conviction is not unduly prejudicial, why wouldn't that require us to affirm?
Because there is nowhere on the record that he actually did a balancing test. There was nothing proffered on the record as to the circumstances of the prior conviction. Was it a male? Was it a female? Was it a young child? Was it an older child? What were the circumstances? Nothing was proffered. As a matter of fact, the trial judge was unaware of the statute, and in the record, one can almost in one's mind's eye see what happened, which is when it was introduced by the Commonwealth's attorney, and when it was objected to, the trial judge, it appeared, tried to turn to look for a book, and the Commonwealth attorney offered him, "Here, Your Honor, look at my copy." The Commonwealth attorney stated that this was a special exception, and we would argue that it's not a special exception to 2:403, which specifically is cited within the statute in E.
It's an exception to the general rule that propensity evidence is not admissible. And following the federal rules, the statute's enacting saying, in these types of cases, propensity evidence is admissible as long as notice is given, blah, 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 and then the rule that says, and it refers to the rule which says, the unfair prejudice, or the prejudice is not, the probative value is not outweighed by undue prejudice. In this case, there was a pretrial motion where not only the prior conviction, but all the facts that led up to that prior conviction were taken into evidence and presumably reviewed by the trial court. And then at the trial, when the Commonwealth went to introduce the motion, the conviction, the defense objected, and the Commonwealth said, Judge, you've already considered this at the pretrial hearing. And the trial judge said, yes, I did, or words to that effect.
Well, Your Honor, in the transcript of the pretrial hearing, there was an objection in the pretrial hearing, and that is where the Commonwealth stated that this is a special exception. And if I may quote, he said that it's a special section set out by the legislature, the statute that contravenes normal rules of evidence. And Your Honor, we would argue that it does not contravene the normal rules of evidence based on E in the statute that says it the normal rules of evidence apply, including Rule 403. And the fact that that was actually set out, including Rule 403, we believe means that the legislature intended that the balancing test be done. And it was not. This was admitted for one reason and one reason only, and that was to inflame the jury. That is also very clear in the record. The only time that it was mentioned at trial was at the beginning of the trial and in closing arguments when it was pointed out, and he's already a convicted sex offender.
Clearly the statute was intended to allow something that wouldn't normally come in to come in. It may be still subject to unduly prejudicial argument, but generally you couldn't introduce a prior conviction like this at the guilt phase of a trial unless it wished to show a pattern or common scheme, correct?
I agree, yes.
All right. So if I can't introduce it for that purpose, the statute clearly allows me to introduce certain convictions that aren't part of a pattern or a common scheme into evidence, correct?
Possibly. I believe that this statute encompasses all of the rules of evidence. And again,
it only references one of them, though, in E.
It references all of them and specifically points out 403. If you look at E in its entirety, it's admitted subject to the rules of evidence, including 403.
But not limited to 403.
So therefore, I ask the question, what was the legislature thinking? And that was a question that came up at the writ panel. And I don't know the answer. I don't know if it was a political issue. The rape shield laws were intended to protect the victim. They were not, in my way of thinking, intended to disenfranchise the alleged perpetrator. In this case, if the court affirms this, we're going to be setting up a two-tiered evidentiary standard. And sex offenders will be held to a different standard, a higher standard, in a sense, than a murderer. These things could be admitted at any time.
But if that wasn't the General Assembly's purpose, what does the statute do at all?
I believe the statute really does very little. I believe that we could offer a prior conviction at the guilt phase in any trial in this Commonwealth. And it could be objected to, and we could ask that the court consider whether the probative value outweighs the prejudicial effect.
Assume robbery.
Okay.
Could I introduce a prior robbery conviction?
I could offer that. I could offer that for to have it admitted into evidence. It could be objected to, and the court could then consider that based upon the rules of evidence and do a balancing test.
But even though it cites the rules of evidence, to the extent that it is, as you suggest, in conflict with the rules of evidence, don't we have to give meaning to the statute? Because, as I said earlier, statutes will always trump rules.
Correct. But again, the statute has incorporated the rule within its body. And
but we can't say that the rules mean that by applying the rules, the statute means nothing.
Well, the statute may mean nothing, but
There's a presumption that it doesn't mean nothing.
Correct.
And it doesn't, you know, your response goes you could offer the robbery conviction, and I guess that's true. Without any statutory basis, you can offer any potential piece of evidence you want, but the statute doesn't say that you're allowed to offer the conviction. It says it is admissible and may be considered. That's not offering, that's admitting.
It is admissible, but
no,
I believe...
It doesn't say it is admissible. It says is admissible and may be considered. It is the belief is absent some other circumstance. Unlike the robbery conviction, these child sex offenses get to the jury. That's a change of the basic general rule.
If in fact we're going to stop reading right where you stopped reading, I would agree with the court. However, the statute needs to be read as a whole. And as a whole, the rules of evidence apply, and they have been incorporated into the statute. In this case, Your Honors, this is a statutory interpretation question. It's also a question of disenfranchisement of Mr. Blankenship. And if you do, and I would like to incorporate specifically my reply brief and also my brief, the jury considered this. The jury asked for a cleaner copy of the prior conviction. The jury then, when found out they couldn't have it, asked for a magnifying glass so that they could look at the prior conviction. And within less than 30 minutes of the magnifying glass, they found him guilty. We do not believe this was harmless error. We do believe that it was highly prejudicial and that Mr. Blankenship was, in fact, disenfranchised and his statutory and constitutional protections were not afforded him. Thank you.
May it please the court. This statute was enacted in 2014. At that time, we had decades of cases about other crimes evidence and when it was admissible and when it wasn't. The rules of evidence were codified in Virginia in 2012. And not to sound like a history lesson, but in 1995, the federal government enacted 413 and 414, which are very close here. I think it's very important that because we don't have any cases on 18267.7:1 in state court, that we look at what the federal courts have done. And Ms. Fitzgerald included two of those cases in the brief. The legislature is enacting this rule to protect children. And yes, the statute and its counterpart rule of 2:413 reference the potential for exclusion. But this is exactly backwards from the normal analysis that we do. The normal analysis is, as we find in 2:404, except as provided in 2:413, which codifies this statute, evidence of other crimes, wrongs, or acts are generally not admissible. Well, now what we have is a sea change, as the Tenth Circuit said in the Guardia case that's cited in our brief. The sea change is generally these are admissible, but not automatically. So in Section E of the statute, the legislature provided that the evidence offered in accordance with this statute shall be subject to exclusion in accordance with the rules of evidence, not limited to 2:403. Well, yes, if in fact this evidence lacked foundation, if this evidence lacked authentication, if it was not the best evidence, there are any number of rules of evidence that could apply.
Is this just a rule of propensity?
Yes.
And if the prior, I mean, this deals with child sexual assault cases, if the prior conviction was, for instance, an acquaintance rape 10 years ago that had nothing to do with any kind of child pedophilia, anything, you arguing that would not meet the relevancy standard?
Well, I think that I think what would happen there
not,
is that it would be relevant, but it's only relevant evidence that's subjected to the probative versus prejudice balancing test. And that's why that particular language is in the statute and it's in the corresponding rule.
Was there sufficient balancing evidence on the record by the pretrial hearing?
I think that there is sufficient balancing discussed in this case. And here's what happened. And I think it's very interesting that what happened at the pretrial hearing is that there was an objection made to after the Commonwealth had given notice about introducing the prior indecent liberties conviction. But the request was, and Judge, if you do let it in, don't let in any of the other information about it. Because there are pages and pages of other information of exactly what happened. The prior crime did involve a child in a car, and the defendant in that case was doing sexual things and making the child watch. That's what's in the papers that were filed by the Commonwealth. So initially, at the pretrial hearing, there's not
what
a lot
the
of discussion.
What is the pretrial hearing? Because I don't.
It's the day before trial. I think the pretrial is 7:20, and the trial is maybe 7:21 in 2015.
Am I missing it? Is that in the?
It
appendix?
Is in the appendix, Your Honor. The
it's
pertinent pages are 15 through 19, and that is the pretrial hearing. And there, the defense attorney argued that there was no other purpose for this than to inflame the jury, and it shouldn't come in, and the judge takes a look at the statute. And the prosecutor quite rightly says, this is change. This is a change in the way we are introducing other crimes evidence. And so then the very next day, and the court says he's going to follow the statute. The next day, before the trial begins, and now we're looking at 35 through about 38 in the appendix, counsel wanted to renew the motion, and at this point argues, well, I'm at the bottom of 35. I renew the objection and rely on Rule 2:403 in the code section. And we would add that this case can't be used to convict the defendant alone, and it would be prejudicial. So then the prosecutor argues, well, this is the special section. And then down about line 21, the prosecutor says, the court has a way process. I think another way of saying balancing process, that it goes through. And I know the court has already gone through that. And we feel that this meets the balancing test. The balance is in favor of the defendant. So we have both the defendant and the Commonwealth saying there's a balancing test to be done. And the prosecutor says to the judge, I know you've already done that balancing test. I don't think we assume the judge did not do something that both parties said needed to be done. And the prosecutor even said, Judge, I know you've already done this. And the court doesn't say, well, no, I didn't. I don't have to. I think that,
that's not part of the record?
Oh, it is. This is part
The balancing test. It's not in the record itself. You're just assuming that in his mind he did it?
There's no discussion by the court of the balancing that the court did. Well, you know, and I take that back, though. Look at on page 37. The court is discussing this matter again. I'm looking towards the bottom, maybe 20 through 25. And the court says, one of the charges he has today is the same charge for which the Commonwealth is attempting to introduce. So I think that kind of goes more to the weight of introduction. The court will overrule the objection. I think you can look at that, and the judge is saying, well, the North Carolina conviction you want to introduce is just like the case that's here.
It certainly addressed Judge Petty's hypothetical of a case where it's an acquaintance rape versus a crime involving a child.
Or something that was very, very different. And so I think that if you look at both of those pages from the hearing that occurred the morning of trial, that we do have evidence that the court complied and did a balancing test, and it certainly meets a balancing test. When you look at the documents that were presented in the pretrial motion by the prosecution and the case that we have here. And so I think it's interesting because we don't have any state case law to look at this, these federal cases that discuss how this is a sea change and that propensity evidence is relevant. It's very relevant. But the decision has been made by our legislatures that it's too dangerous to introduce it, so we're not going to. But now the legislature in Virginia, as the federal government did in 1995, has said, you know, in this category of cases, we're gonna put the shoe on the other foot. We're going to say this is likely admissible, but it could be excluded, as opposed to this is not admissible unless you can come up with an exception. And so that is what is happening in this case. And so it's not to inflame the jury.
Any standards that the court is supposed to consider, such as, you know, the prior conviction is too remote in time, or?
Well, Your Honor, I think that might go into the whole balancing test. This had some age on it. This was from 1999, 79. But it was the same kind of crime. And so if there is a propensity that can be considered, and it would appear that in this category of case that it can, if it is not, I stumble over this myself, if the probative value is not substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice, that's the test on balancing. That also includes confusing or misleading the jury. But, I mean, that's the test, substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice. And that's what the case law says. That's what the statute, rule of evidence says. And so in this case, we're not looking at automatic admission, but we are looking at a different way, a sea change, if you will, to use the Tenth Circuit's recitation on that. So the balancing that was...
Is that because in the law prior to this statute being enacted, there was sort of a presumption, or it was that type of other crimes evidence was not admissible unless...
That's correct.
And here it is. It is admissible
unless. Exactly. That's exactly. And I think that when you look at the rule of evidence 2:404B, that's the rule you look for. As far as evidence of getting other crimes in, but now there's something that says except in,
however,
rule the 2:413, which is our state introduction of other crimes, sexual crimes.
If it is admissible unless rule 403 keeps it out, is it incumbent upon the defendant to argue to the court why Rule 403 should apply?
Yes.
Did that happen here? Was there any specific argument as to why this particular conviction was not admissible?
Your Honor, there really was not specific argument. The argument was made that under 2:403, the evidence should not be admitted. But of course, at the pretrial hearing, it was the effort of the defense to keep all of the other information away from the jury. And I think that's right, that the jury gets the conviction order. But there was not a lot of discussion at the hearing, either pretrial or trial, with regard to the facts.
I'm just thinking out loud. Does the defendant have an obligation to alert the trial court as to why this particular conviction does not meet the standards of the rule of admissibility?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and I think what we were just talking about, how under normal circumstances it's the prosecution's burden to say why we meet an exception to get in what is normally not admissible. And so now it's the prosecution's burden to say, I'm offering this because under this rule it's admissible, unless there is a reason that it's not, unless there's a reason it should be excluded. And it seems that would fall upon the party that doesn't want the evidence to be admitted to do that. I realize it's a criminal defendant, but I mean, just thinking logically over how this is the exact opposite of the way we have been operating for a long time.
I mean, our 518 language says it's not enough to make a general objection.
Right.
It has to be a specific objection.
That's right.
Which would, to me, include something like my prior hypothetical. This prior conviction involves an adult 30 years ago.
You know, some other reason why it would not. So it's our position, obviously, that It's not a double standard. It is that the legislature has determined there's a different standard. There's going to be a different standard in these kind of cases. And this is not the only statute where the legislature has offered some special protections for children, and especially children who are victims of sexual assault. And so this is not inconsistent with some things that the legislature has done. I will say, just as a matter of response to an argument that was made about the jury asking the questions, and this court said in Kennemore in 50 Virginia App that we don't look at questions that a jury asks in deciding how they have decided a case. And so I would say that it's not appropriate to look at the questions that they asked and say they were improper.
Certainly regarding the question of whether it was admissible under the statute or not, the jury question is irrelevant because you have to make the admissibility determination before you know that they're going to ask a question.
Yes, it is. And they were instructed in Instruction 19 that they could not convict this defendant based on the fact that he was, it's not proof he committed the crime today. The proof that he committed the other crime is not proof that he committed the crime that was before them. And just as another note, the jury did impose minimal sentences, except on the indecent liberties, they had a mandatory sentence because this was a subsequent. That's how the jury was instructed. And under 18267 point whatever it is, this fell into that category of an offense that has an enhanced punishment. And it is not an enhanced element, it is an enhanced punishment. So the evidence was quite strong, and the evidence, I see I'm running short on time, that they had of receiving the receipt in the defendant's pocket, the security footage from Walmart, the fact that he was wearing no underwear, the fact that the drink at the crime scene was still cool, and the defendant was hysterical when she visited it. I mean, the evidence was quite overwhelming of his guilt. It was definitely, any question of error, this was harmless error. Of course, it's our position that it was not error to begin with, but since courts always do harmless error analysis when they're considering error, I wanted to bring that up.
Just on one point that you mentioned, it kind of tickled me my mind on something. You say that this was a second offense, so this evidence would have to be established at minimum at sentencing.
It's a sentencing factor. It is not the guilt stage.
Is there any case law on that? I'm drawing a blank.
No, I looked at the statute yesterday when I realized how he had been sentenced, and I noticed that it doesn't say that it had to be included in the charging instrument. It just mentions that if you have a subsequent conviction within 20 years, then the punishment is the maximum of whatever charge is.
We've got a number of statutes that have second offense enhanced punishment,
right.
And I'm thinking, for instance, distribution of drugs.
Right, and I think those require that they actually be charged in the charging instrument and proved as an element, and this is not that instance, because that was my concern when I read the verdict, but that is not where we are.
We haven't ever decided that.
I don't know. I don't know the answer. I know that it does not, the statute does not require it. For all the reasons that we've argued today and on the brief, we would urge this court to affirm the circuit court.
Very briefly, again, I believe that the record is very important to read, it was clear that the court was unfamiliar with the statute. It was clear in the record that the court relied upon the instruction or the information provided by the Commonwealth's attorney that this comes in by statute. And I did hear the Commonwealth say in argument that, well, subject to all these other things. Well, that was never said. It comes in by statute. We believe that A and B and maybe even C were considered, but E was never brought to the attention of the court, and the court did not read the statute, and that this was a matter of an abuse of discretion.
Does the defendant have an obligation to make a specific argument to the court why it's not admissible? Not just that it's not admissible, but that it's overly prejudicial because?
I don't know, honestly. I thought of that question, and I made it pretty simple for myself. There are three players here. There's Commonwealth's attorney whose job is to admit it. There's the defense attorney whose job is to object to it. with specificity, and I would say he did. He objected based on 403. And then there's the court's role in this, and that is to know that Rule 403 requires that I do a balancing test. And at no time on the record, there was an assumption by the Commonwealth attorney, and I would argue that maybe he realized balancing test wasn't done, so I better say it on the record. You balanced it, Judge. Nowhere in the record did the judge balance it. The judge clearly admitted it based upon the statement by the Commonwealth's attorney that it came in by statute, and he said that.
Absent the statute, there's no way it comes in, correct?
It could come in if the probative value outweighed the prejudicial effect, if it showed the common scheme or plan. I mean, there are ways it could have come in.
Assuming it's insufficient to show common scheme or plan, and I think I'm pretty safe in saying a conviction with this much age on it and distance and time and place would not show common scheme or plan. Assuming no common scheme or plan, absent the statute, there is no argument that it's admissible.
I would agree with that.
So the statute at least changed the state of play in that regard.
Correct. And I don't disagree with that. Our appeal is based upon the fact that the court failed to do the requisite balancing test and therefore disenfranchised Mr. Blankenship. Thank you
very much. We will greet counsel. And our next case is Irby versus Life Point Health Safety et al.